last swig of coffee there. Let me preface just a little bit, because today will be a little bit historical, and so I need to tell you why. Some of you, I don't know, most of you know that over the years, I have about every other summer done a summer reading group here most of the time with the book study of the Pilgrim's Progress. And the first night that we do the Pilgrim's Progress, I give a verbal biography when I pass out the books and explain how our little discussion group is going to work that summer. I begin with a verbal biography of the author, because I think that it helps in understanding the material that we're reading, and especially with Bunyan and Pilgrim's Progress, because it's an allegory. But I diverted from that one summer, and we did the Dietrich Bonhoeffer book, Life Together. And a couple of the pastors had mentioned that I ought to kick around revisiting that six-week group this summer, partly because of what we've been doing in Acts and what Pastor Brian's been doing in the seven churches, and then, of course, where I am usually in Pastor Otto's group, and we just completed James, all very church-heavy material. Not that the New Testament isn't full of that, but at any rate, Life Together is, in my opinion, and it was the book. Pastor Brian mentioned that he was going to mention another book, a book last week when he was preaching on the church that he wanted to recommend to everyone, because he tries to recommend for the reading, and then he mentioned the Jerry Bridges book. The book he was going to mention was Life Together. It's just this little book right here, about 120 pages, 130 pages maybe, Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Now the first, and these are my Bonhoeffer books. I brought them because, so I've done my homework. Now Bunyan, if you read any biography of Bunyan, the thing that makes them more or less interesting is the angle or emphasis of the author of that biography. With and then, of course, there is John Bunyan's own spiritual autobiography, which is called Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, which is also a terrific book, another small book, about 120 pages. But with Bonhoeffer being far more recent, right, World War II, there's so much more material. Bunyan authored a lot of books, but 58 books John Bunyan authored. And there's a lot of material out there from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but because he's so recent and a controversial figure, both theologically and practically, that there's just so much more out there. And in fact, before I developed the verbal biography that I did the first night that we did Life Together, I read one biography, two smaller biographies, a couple hundred pages, and then this 600-page Eric Metaxas, just opus of a work there. But at any rate, he is a controversial figure, but to me, the book on the New Testament church is Life Together. I learned more about how to be with you in this book years ago than probably any other thing. And so it has made, I used to have this obscure little blog that I would write on just like once a quarter, and one of the posts that I had there was called Dead Friends. And it was just a little paragraph about a couple of different people, namely John Bunyan and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I can read things by Dietrich Bonhoeffer and tear up because I know him so well. And there are good documentaries. And if you've seen the Tom Cruise film Valkyrie, there are scenes from Valkyrie where he is in a secret meeting room, and there's maybe 40 or 50 people in there, and they all have their own little role, in this scheme to essentially assassinate, and there were several attempts, Adolf Hitler. And by the way, I'll try to be more detailed as we continue here, because not everyone in this room is probably familiar with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. But now, he's not mentioned in the film, but in those scenes where they have these secret meetings and you just get this, the camera just kind of pans around the room with these people that are involved, and it's just, it's very, very, I mean, they could be, you know, killed just for meeting there. And it's very intense, and they do a great job with that film. I recommend it to you. And it was on Netflix last I checked, but at any rate, Bonhoeffer would have been in that room. He was one of the people that would have been in that room. But anyway, just so that's just a little background of why we would do this here this morning. You came for Bible study. Well, I get, you know, 40 minutes of fill-in. And so this is what I chose to do, partly because I've been encouraged to perhaps revisit life together this summer, and I'm kicking that around, and this is to perhaps whet some of your appetites in case, because one of the things that I want to do before I devote myself to such an endeavor is to feel you all out, you know, what would be the interest in such a thing. I can tell you that in three efforts in Pilgrim's Progress, I mean, 200 people have now read Pilgrim's Progress that hadn't before, and that's exciting to me. And then we had a really large group, and that's including outsiders. I don't know how it happens, but we always get people in our little summer discussion groups in from other churches, and that's exciting as well. Kind of branch out our webby little fingers, right? So, anyway, let me pray, and then we'll really start here. And let me tell you this. It took me 120 minutes to do this verbal biography the first night of Life Together a few summers ago. We'll cut off when we normally do here. You're going to need the break before Pastor Brian begins the second hour. But so it'll probably be an awkward point that we stop, but I hope that some of the history here and whatever, you know, practical implications I can parenthesize along the way will be, will have an effect on you. Our Father and our God, especially with the awkward material and certainly an awkward man, would you be with us this hour and not leave us to ourselves, not leave us to our tired spirits and our weary minds and bodies, but would you give us something of yourself, something just very close to you, something tasty to revive our very souls. Would you do that this hour and the next, and also make us mindful of those around us who are suffering, and make us a comforting spirit to them. We pray it in Christ's name. Amen. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer is born in Germany in 1906, the youngest of eight children, including his twin sister, Sabine. And they are born to Karl and Paula Bonhoeffer. You've probably heard of Karl Bonhoeffer, whether or not you knew it was he was related or not, but he was actually intricately involved in, strangely enough, the science behind the development of the first, well, of the H-bomb, which became a key, obviously a key moment in World War II, in fact, in ending it. So that's a very interesting tie there. Now, don't get me wrong, he didn't work for the military, wasn't involved in the development of the bomb, but the science that behind what made that possible. And, you know, as I speak here, I should be aware, and I want to just acknowledge publicly right now, that when in discussing just war theory, there can be varying views, and there might be even in this room. I'm going to give you the history here. If you want to hang out with me in life together this summer, maybe, then we can have other discussions about just war theory, and even, frankly, just lie theory, which is funny. Some people that believe in just war are against a just lie, which has always been a little strange to me. But Bonhoeffer wrote extensively about both, and a wartime ethic. And in some of his books, Letters and Papers from Prison, the book called Ethics, it deals with a lot of those issues. And the reason why I became interested in Bonhoeffer at all was because I was reading another book by Oz Guinness, and he kept referring to Bonhoeffer in some very, very, very deep philosophical thoughts that I'd never thought before. And I just wanted to know more. But he died in 1945 in Flossenbürg Gestapo prison camp. So he was, that makes him 39 years old at that time. I'll be 42 in a few months. And haven't done 1/1,000th of anything of an effective life in comparison. But different times and places for different people. His father was very respected. They lived very affluent. This was not, you know, this isn't a rags-to-riches story. His brother, Carl Friedrich, was also very important in the and helped split the atom. And his brother Carl Friedrich, named after his father, Carl, in 1923. And then Dietrich decided early on that he desired to be a theologian. Now, when at that time and in Europe, what you meant by theologian was a philosophical theologian, and there are reasons for that with influences that I'll get to in a moment. He was a top student anywhere he went and was admired by his peers and faculty. Eventually, his doctoral dissertation was called Sanctorum Communio, which means communion of the saints, the church, and the idea of the church, the universal church, which is all believers of all time everywhere, and the local church, and especially the local church would become very important to him later. His postdoctoral work was called Act and Being, a very philosophical work, and in fact, if you read any of his books, they have very philosophical portions that are difficult for most of us to read. He was pondering the question, you get from those titles, he was pondering the question of the church from a very early on, and it would suit him for his several eventual struggles for the church in Germany. He learned under very famous theologians of the 20th century, namely Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, and you probably may or may not have heard of Schleiermacher and Harnack, but they were liberal theologians at the time. And so he went through a lot of change and altering throughout his life theologically. He began as an anti-Semite, but as Providence would have it, he would find himself in New York around the middle of his life, and he, in his time in New York, spent a lot of time in Harlem, and in Harlem, he was introduced to the black church and the plight of the Negroes in America at the time, and in his mind, he went to the Jews in Germany and did a 180 on the Jews, which again would be very important for in just a few years, as with the rise of the Third Reich. So, very important time, his limited time in America and in the black church. By the way, the entire time he was in America, he attended as the kind of the lone, the token white fella at the in one of the what he called the Negro churches in Harlem, and he loved it there, and he loved their passion, and he tried to be influential theologically there, and also understand what they were facing socially. He loved theology and philosophy, but his great passion was for discipleship. And in his, and you see that in the book Life Together. It's what is preached here at Countryside so much, discipleship amongst one another. There isn't a program of discipleship at Countryside. That's Life Together. That's what you do. You preach the gospel to yourself, to your already converted brother in the pew next to you, or in the cushy Johnson County chair, and to the world. And you do that. That's why we don't need a program, because Jesus said you do it. And we, of course, do have some outreach efforts, including VBS and Junior Camp, and obviously Journey to Judea and so on. So we aren't without some community or organized community efforts. But in Life Together, you see it, and in the cost of discipleship. Now, you can listen to these books, and the cost of discipleship is difficult and sometimes even tedious, but I think tremendous, and I've read it, and I've also listened to it. There are good, if you've done very much audiobook, there are good readers, and there are some that are not so good. And so you'll want to test, if you're interested in that, you'll want to test that. But it is worth, the cost of discipleship is worth it, is worth, you know, sort of almost trudging through parts of it. But just that idea, the phrase alone, the title alone, the cost of discipleship, and you know where he's going with that, right? Tell me where. What's he talking about? Jesus. Come on, gang. I know we like to ignore the difficult passages in white, affluent, middle of America, right? You're not worthy to be my disciple. It's hard. If what? If you love this world, your own family, some of you will be killed, etc. Bonhoeffer didn't believe in avoidance ethics merely. You know, that's what we think of as Christianity. If you have to live in wartime and really be a Christian, like first century, like if you don't forsake your family for me, if you're not willing to take up your own cross, you're not worthy to be my disciple. If that's not where you live, which is everybody in this room, it's very difficult to be a Christian, because Jesus said what? It's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom. And everybody in this room is stinking rich in one way or a dozen. And you may not feel like it when you don't feel healthy, or if you had to skip one payment on your mortgage or whatever. But look, comparatively, we're rich. And certainly in a church like this, spiritually, we are filthy rich. And we walk out the doors and we forget what we look like, right? The Word is a mirror, and yet we look in it, and we see ourselves for a moment, and we walk out the door and forgot what we look like. Because we live as if we're the center of the universe. But he knew nothing of that Christianity, mere avoidance ethics. Like, well, I don't do these things, and I do these handfuls of things. That's what most of us think of as Christianity. Meanwhile, Bonhoeffer, at one point, when he is struggling to try to keep the church in Germany together, at any given evening, he can look over his shoulder and watch another church burn. If I was doing the verbal biography and Life Together this summer at this rate, be there a long time. So he was a leader. Wherever he was a leader. He was a friend. He made friends in the Gestapo prison. Some of the Gestapo really enjoyed Bonhoeffer, really respected him. Really, they liked him. In fact, some of them stuck their necks out for him just to have pen and paper or to get a letter out and so on. And it was simply by being the winsome man that he was. Winsome. 1933, oh, I'm sorry, he was a leader, a friend everywhere he went, a pastor. He was an intellectual resource for everyone around him. He just was an intellectual resource for everyone around him. You know, I know people like that. Like I have friends that, like, if it's any one of five categories, I know who to go to. You know, like that person, if it's one of these five things, I go to that person. If it's one of these, you know, things, I go to somebody else, and so on. And it's good to share yourself with people that way. By 1933, Adolf Hitler is elected chancellor, and through his systematic propaganda that you've learned about in history, he immediately began the systematic propaganda, and he began to establish his own authority and favor. And then you had what was called the Jewish question. And I'll get to that more, because the churches began to ask the Jewish question and whether or not they ought to compromise in regard to the Jews, because Hitler was even, in his propaganda, even used the Bible to dismiss the Jews. And the first way to get someone villainized and then essentially, what do you call that when you just extinguish a group? I'm sorry? Exterminate. Yeah, just an first just unlawful treatment and then just extermination. You have to get there by the frog boiling, right? You know, how they say that if you can boil a frog alive, if you do it slow enough, they don't feel it. If you go up too quickly, the frog jumps out. It's, wait a minute, I'm boiling here. And you do it slow enough, though, Hitler, and you can boil a frog alive. So you do it slowly, and you do it theologically, and then practically, and so on. And before you know it, you not only villainize, but you get everybody ready to just exterminate an entire people group. And also part of it is that in a civilized society, nobody can believe that's what's coming. And so the Jewish question begins to arise amongst the churches. And as soon as they begin to compromise, Bonhoeffer's ears are perked up. And he's already begun pondering the ethics of such things, what ethics really means, and eventually came to this. And this is important for your understanding of him. Okay, and I'm not saying Bonhoeffer was right about everything. I'm not saying certainly that he was theologically correct about everything. He is a controversial historical figure, but I just want to encourage you, and I'll do this if we do this summer, to see a person through the lenses of where they are. You know, the churches are burning. 6 million Jews are dying. That's just the Jews. The world's at war, right? The name of Christ, in any real biblical sense, is being wiped out of an entire country, almost continent, in any real gospel sense. What are you going to do? How are you going to act? And so see him through those lenses. Because as he's working on ethics, this is what he came to. He wrote this. that for Christianity, I'm sorry, for the Christian, there is first questioning the state, followed by aiding the victims, and then being a spoke in the wheel. And in fact, my first Bonhoeffer biography that I read was called A Spoke in the Wheel, and it was actually written by his niece and Renate Wind. And so you question the state, so you're going to challenge what's going on, and you do so lawfully, and they did. And then you aid the victims. And at that point is where you come to Bonhoeffer's just lie theory, that if the Gestapo bangs on the door and they say, "Hey, are you hiding Jews under the floor?" And Bonhoeffer would argue, you are not obligated to tell the persecutor. "My name is George Washington, and I cannot tell a lie. There are Jews under the floorboards." That you're not obligated to do that. In fact, his ethic would be that you are required by righteousness to protect the victim. And so he went question the state, followed by aid the victim, and then be a spoke in the wheel. Now, if you haven't already departed from Bonhoeffer with his just lie, then you will probably with the spoke in the wheel, because by a spoke in the wheel, he means the wheels are turning and they're going and it's picking up steam, and you shove a broom handle into the bike wheel so that, you know, you have a collapse there. And that was what he eventually became a part of. Any questions or comments so far? Anybody? I don't want to just lecture you on history. Although I hope it's not just a historical lecture. Nobody? All right. Well, I'm going to do this anyway. I would normally do this while you... Oh, we do have one. We would normally do this while someone asks a question. Fitting. Yes, Kellen.
What exactly do you mean by being a spoke in the wheel? How far would you go in that regard?
Well, for Bonhoeffer, that meant being at least part of the effort to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Because the idea was, if you cut the head off the snake will die. And he thought that that 6 million Jews and you know, the decimation of the entire German church and almost European church was meant that Pharaoh's sons die. Pharaoh's firstborn dies. That's where he ended up. Now, he struggled a great deal, and you can read about it in his letters and such. It wasn't an easy decision for him, but he began, as I said, very, very early on, dealing with theology and in philosophical theology very deeply on a lot of these issues before they ever were, you know, a real issue. So that's how far he would go. If you watch the film Valkyrie, the Tom Cruise film, he was part of those efforts that you see in that film, those failed efforts to assassinate Adolf Hitler. A small part, but something of a courier of illegal papers and things like that. But he was, because of his place in society, he was able to, he had connections and was able to be involved that way. Just a small piece, but he was involved in those secret meetings and so on. And it's just very, like, even just when you read those things and the sweat just, you know, beating on their brows just from being on your way to a place, you know, at a time and an hour and saying things. And you don't know who in the room might be a mole. And there were some. Just, you know, think about stuff like that next time you're nervous for, like, a job interview. You know? What are they going to do to you? When the Lord clothes the daisies and feeds the birds. Okay. This was history, and I got preachy. So over just a few years, Hitler managed to win over most of the public, including the German church, and was indoctrinating them against the Jews. And this was Bonhoeffer's first battle in the church. First battle he fought was in the church. Make a note. And then let me say this about Hitler's brilliance. Because we're very patriotic. You know, one of the great things about 9/11 when it happened, that sounds silly, doesn't it? You know what was really great about 9/11? One of the things that came out of such, you know, tragedy, what in our nation was a great tragedy, which, by the way, there's a 9/11 every day somewhere else in the world that you don't care about. But one of the great things was a new sort of patriotism. And certain political parties and so on, really, businesses and financial institutions and so on, really love middle of white America patriotism. You know, church on Sunday, don't be late, got a pew with your name on it, and you're always at work, and you're contributing to the gross national product 5 or 6 days a week, and you go on vacations and so on, and that's all very important to make, you know, the world go round, at least in our little world. But something about, one negative about patriotism, though, is it can make you very imbalanced if you are more American than you are Christian. And that's what happened in Germany, because Hitler really, you know, and the home of the chiefs, right? That's what they do on Sunday at Arrowhead Stadium, because you know, that's where you are, and you get into it, and you're excited, and that's what he did for everybody with, you know, with Christian undertones. Germanism, not Christianity. Germanism was equal to, and then higher than, was essentially the highest Christianity, was Germanism. So upon the decision, that's Dietrich's first battle is in the church. And upon the decision that the German church had left Christianity in any true sense, this was Bonhoeffer's assessment of the German church, that they had, when they abandoned the Jews, they had left any true sense of Christianity, any gospel Christianity at all. And he and others began what they called the confessing church, because they weren't, they needed to be something other than the church in Germany, which had lost its Christ-ness. And at this point, they tried to make the Christian voice heard again in the public and in the political arena. And there was a book burning ordered by one of Adolf Hitler's top officials, where any Jewish titles or authors were thrown into fires in towns all over Germany. And they did everything by radio, you know, at that time. And Heinrich Heine perhaps had no idea how prophetic his words were when he said this at that time. And I believe he said this because we've seen it before during the Reformation. But Heinrich Heine said this: where books are burned, they will, in the end, burn people too. Very prophetic, with the coming gas chambers and such. Hitler was greatly influenced by Friedrich Nietzsche and his will to power, which is quoted directly in Hitler's famous writing, Mein Kampf, which is translated in English, my struggle. Nietzsche wrote of a super race of men who could conquer any other people, and he saw that coming. That's coming. And Hitler believed it. So Adolf, the patriot, true patriot, believed that this people was the German. They could be that. But that the German must be purified from the weaker races and religions. And so that's what he systematically began to do. I can't even fathom the energy to take 30 years to unfold all of that. You know? Like, I don't know what I have planned next weekend. Just the level of commitment and genius. Just tremendous. It was probably the liberal theologians, Harnack and Schleiermacher, who unwittingly loosened up the church in Germany for Adolf Hitler's rise. Just a few years before his rise, they and their theological perspectives that were influencing all of... So let me tell you, the seminary campuses matter, and the Bible studies that go on at Countryside matter, because you can be ever so loosened up. You could be, you know, just greased just enough to accept things that don't belong in the gospel. And that is the consequences of ideas. So while Dietrich and others remained in the questioning the state stage of the resistance, he wrote in a letter to his grandmother, he wrote this: the question is really Christianity or Germanism. Like, I've come to this. It's Christianity or Germanism. And the sooner the conflict is revealed in the clear of day, the better. Make people decide. You know, even when you're talking to someone about the gospel, you know, you can give them the information and you can share your own personal testimony, right? But at some point, don't be afraid to say, look, where else are you going to go? Because you and I both know. The scriptures say that you know. Romans 1, right? And Romans 2. You know in your foolish, darkened heart and mind. And you know in your conscience. That's every man. So you know that they know. And so it's okay to sometimes say, Look, fine, like we're bantering about, but let me just, I just got to ask you, where else are you going to go when it comes to the question of what will you do with your sin? Getting the real question out in the daylight, out in the clear. Christianity or Germanism. It wasn't only society and politics Hitler was dictating to, but it was also the church, and he had them adopt the what was called the Arian Clause, which basically took many pastors out of their role as pastor at all, and that was the first step. If you were Jewish, you could no longer be clergy anywhere in Germany. And there was a group formed by Dietrich and others called the Pastors Emergency League, the PEL. The Pastors Emergency League tried to influence the church in Germany not to sign off on such mandates, and they had a few successful efforts, however temporary. And what they would do is they would scramble and they'd go, no, these people are ready, and they'd scramble and they'd get everybody together, and in the middle of the night they're banging on the doors and saying, listen, I gotta tell you what's at stake here, please. And sometimes for a few weeks or a few months they had somebody convinced, and then the pressure would get too great and the beads of sweat would get too heavy, and they would sign. And that's how assimilation works, by the way. It's the boiling frog. It's just the slow pressure until you really can't take it anymore, and everything just starts to cave in, and you become something entirely different, namely frog legs. So the group, and I gotta find a spot to leave you all hanging. Actually, I hope that you'll have that sense that what's the rest of the story? And then you can, if you don't do life together, if I don't do it this summer, if none of that happens, you can look into these things on your own because you're interested. So the group was eventually disbanded, though, from threat and weakness in the leadership, even in the PEL, the Pastors Emergency League, and the threats of imprisonment. And one of the founders, Niemöller, wrote of the German church after 8 years of imprisonment. He was imprisoned 8 years. Now, when he was imprisoned, that was a big deal. He was one of the leaders, and everybody else got super scared. Man, they took Niemöller. They have no shame whatsoever. They took Niemöller. What are they going to do to us? You know, far larger scale. They took the Jesus, Peter. I never knew him. I didn't even know what you're talking about. Never seen that guy before in my life. And let me just read to you something Niemöller wrote here briefly. I'm sorry. For some of you, this is tedious, and it's. But he wrote this, and you've perhaps even heard someone quote this before, so just bear with me. But first, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. They came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me. And there was no one left to speak for me. So while we do not want to adopt a social gospel, you know, we're a mere political and social voice, don't forget true religion, James. Widows and orphans. The victims, the forgotten. And Bonhoeffer wrote rather prophetically in a letter that this was the real struggle. The real struggle that perhaps lies ahead must simply be to suffer faithfully. You know, with the rise of the interest in entertainment of the whole zombie craze that has happened in the last, I don't know how long, 5 or 10 years, I don't know. There's an appeal to me, and I want to tell you why. It appeals to me to simplify my life. Where's my food and water today? And protect the people I love around me. That really appeals to me. I don't need a social security number in that state, you know, and a Google account and whatever. That really appeals to me. So I enjoy these time periods like this where the struggles get so clear, and you're not worried about April 15th anymore. You know? Or it used to be April 15th. Did they change that? There's an extension now. I don't know. That's tax day for some of you who are about 15 days late right now. So he considered himself something of a Jeremiah and had a message for the church in Germany, much like the prophets to Israel. And I'm going to read just that to you, and then we'll probably just close. Because some of you will be bothered if we don't have a little more scripture. The picture that Bonhoeffer painted for Jeremiah was one of the unrelieved gloom and drama. And if you read Jeremiah and Lamentations, you can feel that. God was after him, and he could not escape. And Bonhoeffer referred to the arrow of the Almighty striking down its hunted game. Now, this is not an arrow of the Almighty to kill. It was, I'm going to have you, Jeremiah, and I'm going to have you to do my painful work. And you will suffer so that my word goes out. And Bonhoeffer related to that. And he said this. This path will lead right down into the deepest situation of human powerlessness. The follower becomes a laughingstock, scorned and taken for a fool, but a fool who is extremely dangerous to people's peace and comfort, so that he or she must be beaten, locked up, tortured, if not put to death right away. And this is exactly what became of this man, Jeremiah, because he could not get away from God. For most of us, it'll be the other way. When we're refusing to serve, God will make it painful till you do. But for some, the few called Jeremiah, and I would say Bonhoeffer, the call is to serve and suffer. And I enjoy contemplating things to deepen my own soul like this and my own commitment. And we'll stop there. And I just entreat you to have a God-centered, self-evaluating, but self-diminishing next 90 minutes amongst one another and under the Word. Thank you.